In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Yep.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, yes, it is time to talk movies past the popcorn here on Downtown. Alan Adams joining us in studio. Hello there, sir.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing very well. We were chatting before. You got your shorts on today, and you were confident you can make it through the month of October without having to go to pants.
I'm feeling pretty good about it. Looking at the advanced forecasts and stuff, like the temperatures are dropping, but they're not. They're still, I think, at or a little above the seasonal usual. So I like my chances.
Yeah, I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking to myself, one of the many reasons I love you is that we share this in common. Is there any, like, if somebody said to you, get in the most comfortable outfit you can have, for me, it would be
long sleeves and shorts. Long sleeves and shorts.
That's like, the greatest combo ever.
It's my favorite. It's good for a total of like 7 or 8 weeks out of the year, like early spring and early fall. Like that's your sweet spot. And it's just like, man, I'm there for it. Like I am all about it. 100%.
Now I would also include in that the shorts, t-shirt, but a long sleeve shirt over the t-shirt.
Yes.
Yep. That works as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You can layer the top if you want.
Right.
That's absolutely fine. Yeah. But yeah, the shorts on the bottom. Yep.
Carrie's horrified by this because I don't believe I've seen Carrie in shorts or a long sleeve shirt.
Shorts, not a problem. Okay. I just don't wear them in the office.
Right.
Because
that's so professional.
Pretty much the only time you see me is in here. But the long sleeve shirt baffles me. I don't understand the appeal of long sleeve shirts.
I don't know what to tell you, Carrie.
Yeah. Now, partly that could be because I've always had trouble finding long sleeve shirts.
Yes. And
most long sleeve shirts are like 3/4 shirts on my arms.
Right.
Unless I spend.
But even in the winter time, you wear short sleeve shirts.
All the time. Yeah. I own like 4 long sleeve shirts maybe that I will wear to a wedding or a funeral or places where they're required.
I am so happy in the summertime when you get one of those cool mornings so you can justify wearing a long sleeve shirt.
So, and it's like, and you almost always have to change it by noontime.
Right,
But just for the moment, it's just that little hint. It's just like, oh yeah, this is the stuff.
Yeah. Sweet spot right there. Love it. All right. Well, enough fashion talk. Because we are the three guys that you want to get your fashion advice from. Let's be honest. You've seen us. You know how good we look. Let's talk movies. You got to see 3 over the weekend, and I'm very curious about all 3. Where do we begin?
Let's start with Halloween Kills.
Okay. Yeah.
It's
by the way, we were watching it before the show. Go to Funny or Die and look at the trailer they've done, their version of it, which stars Pee Wee Herman.
Oh, yes. No, I believe I do need to see that. That seems right. So Halloween Kills, it's the second in the sort of planned David Gordon Green, Danny McBride Halloween, reboot trilogy, kind of reboot, sequel, requel, because it's the basic gist is the previous film, which came out in 2018, was basically a sequel to the original, John Carpenter's original Halloween, essentially erasing all of the many, many terrible sequels to that movie that played out over the years. Jamie Lee Curtis is back, Laurie Strode. So Halloween Kills basically picks up right at where the previous film left off. Laurie Strode, her daughter Karen, played by Judy Greer, and her granddaughter are being rushed to the hospital after their brutal confrontation with Michael Myers at the end of the previous film, where they basically trapped him in the basement and set the house on fire, and were like, that ought to do it.
Yeah.
We pick up there's a brief flashback scene at the beginning of the movie, but we pick up the action, the present day action, they're being whisked to the hospital. They see the first responders going the other way, fire trucks and whatnot. Do the standard, no, let it burn, let it burn. They do not let it burn. The firefighters go in there, start trying to put out the fire. One of them, it's burning so thoroughly that one of them falls through the floor into the basement. And then it's Michael Myers time. And man, doesn't that guy like killing people? Because he does a lot of it. Just watching him just cut a swath through all these poor firefighters. You know, at one point, one of them has one of those big, like cut people out of car, like rotary saws.
Yeah.
That doesn't go well for him.
Ooh,
put it that way.
Oh boy.
And there's a lot of that stuff. It's pretty brutal, pretty visceral, pretty gory. But yeah, so, they're, you know, he's out. Meanwhile, it's the 40th. It is Halloween. It's the 40th anniversary of, you know, the original Haddonfield Boogeyman. Like, that's what they call him. And a bunch of locals are at this bar sort of, you know, talking about the legend, telling spooky stories, led by Tommy, who was one of the survivors from the original film, played now by Anthony Michael Hall. Although they did, he is not the same actor that played Tommy in the original film, but they did bring back some of the actors from the original Halloween to reprise those roles in this new movie, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like Kyle Richard was in that movie. And so she's back for this and, you know, just some of that stuff, some tie-in fan service-y type things, which is very cool. But then, you know, word gets out that Michael Myers is back. He's escaped. Tommy decides he's going to put together a posse and they're going to go out and they're going to track him down. This ends tonight. That kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you know, Laurie Strode and her family are at the hospital. She's been sewed up after getting stabbed in the guts from, again, the previous movie. Convinced that Michael's coming for her. And then word gets out, oh, maybe he's coming for her. And so things get, you know, turn into chaos at the hospital. And, you know, it just turns into a thing where the worst in humanity really starts bubbling over as the fear starts to build up surrounding the reappearance of Mr. Michael Myers. Meanwhile, while all these people are panicking, he's just slowly plodding through the town, randomly stopping at houses and just murdering the crap out of people. Like, just, I mean, just brutally, you know, hand-to-hand stuff, sure. Stabbing, okay. As it turns out, he can take a hit. And so it proves very difficult for people to fight him off. And
still get his mask.
Yeah, still got the mask. Nice. That's kind of how it plays out. The biggest issue with this movie is it's very much a middle movie, right. In that you know, you can't really do much as far as like big picture storytelling because you know there's another movie coming, and so it feels like a lot of a lot of brutal murder for brutal murder's sake. Which, don't get me wrong, like a lot of people, that's their jam when it comes to the sort of like spooky movie. And if that's what you're here for, yeah, you're going to be very satisfied. You know, and it's got a dark sense of humor. Like, you kind of get that sort of, those sort of hints of like the Danny McBride influence on the script and stuff like that. But for the most part, it just feels almost like it feels like a placeholder. Like, it's just, you know, it's the sort of deal where it's like, you can't get from point A to point C without point B. This is very much a point B kind of movie. So it's fine for what it is, but if you're expecting anything more than that, you're probably going to be a little disappointed.
All right, that's the word on Halloween Kills. What's up next?
You want to talk about the Velvet Underground documentary?
Yeah, I want to hear what you think about it.
Well, first of all, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm not a huge music guy, never really have been. You know, if you're not a huge music guy, odds are you're not super familiar with the body of work of the Velvet Underground, because they are very much one of those, you know, the band you likes, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Like, they're considered by a lot of people to be one of the more influential bands, rock bands, certainly, of the latter half of the 20th century, let's say. So, you know, I'm not familiar with the body of work beyond, you know, a couple of the big hits, like, you know, like, I mean, Sweet Jane still slaps, all that stuff. But I'm also a huge fan of music documentaries. And so I was very interested, particularly when I realized that it was Todd Haynes who made this movie, who is on it, like, Rich, I can't think, like, you could give me 6 months. I could not come up with a better person to make this movie than Todd Haynes.
Yeah, I mean, the Karen Carpenter film he did, it's just amazing.
Well, you know, and it's like, and he did He's Not There, that crazy right. Bob Dylan biopic yep. where seven different people played Dylan. You know, he did the movie Velvet Goldmine, which was basically a riff on Bowie and Iggy Pop. Like, this is a dude who not only loves music, loves making movies about music, but is passionate about this particular era of music. Mm. And so when you bring all those factors together, particularly when it's such a gifted filmmaker, because Todd Haynes is a hell of a movie maker, you get something that is really kind of spectacular, regardless of your knowledge of the Velvet Underground, which, and again, I caution you, if you're looking for a standard music biopic, like sort of cradle to grave kind of like storytelling kind of situation, this is not that kind of documentary. Like, it's more or less linear, and it kind of follows the path. We get mostly Lou Reed and John Cale as far as like...
Well, and that's what I heard too, is that it really digs deeply into the formation of the Velvet Underground, that like Nico doesn't show up till 20, 30 minutes into the film.
Yeah, it's a pretty extended stretch. And I think that makes sense, because I think because it was you know, a group that did sort of burn very brightly and then sort of collapse under its own weight very, very quickly. When the end came, it came fast. Mm. And so it makes sense that you would get... spend a little bit more time on the developmental periods, particularly because it was such an experimental kind of crew. But, you know, it really starts to cook when we get into when Andy Warhol enters the picture, and the factory where the Velvet Underground was basically the house band at the factory for a couple of years. He managed the group. He helped produce their albums, you know, and I wasn't. Like, you know, I know a little bit. So it's like, I know that, you know, there was some overlap, and I knew that Warhol had some influence and whatnot. I don't think I understood the extent of that influence. And, Todd Haynes sure does, because right from the get-go, he makes this look like basically a 21st century Andy Warhol film.
Oh, wow.
Like, there's all this like split screen stuff. Like, he's basically using the tools at his disposal to kind of recreate that kind of multimedia thing that Warhol kind of pioneered. And so there's a bunch of archival footage, a bunch of found footage type stuff. There's all this footage that he took of the Velvet Underground, of the members of the band. So that's interspersed through there. Lots of voiceover. Some wonderful like interviews. Spent a lot of time with John Cale, who's still around. Spent a lot of time with Maureen Tucker, who's still around. Mm-hmm. Lou Reed obviously has passed away. And just like following them through this experience, and, you know, not only talking to the people who were in the band, but the people who were surrounding the band, all these artists and models and, you know, weird avant-garde filmmakers and musicians, and just this incredible collection of
Jackson Brown part of it too, right?
Yeah, Jackson Brown, because he opened for them at a couple of these I keep wanting to call it the electric plastic explosion. It's not quite that exploding plastic underpants, something like what. But the Warhol events, like, he opened for the band a couple of times, and he comes on and talks about that experience. Maybe my favorite of the sort of outside of the direct sphere interviews was they spent some time with Jonathan Richman, who apparently was a Velvet Underground super fan.
Huh.
Like, he talks about how he saw the band like 60 or 70 times.
Wow.
And he, maybe more than anyone who actually directly spoke to us, really kind of captured what it felt like to him to experience the Velvet Underground live. And I guess that's the big thing. And that's the sort of the overarching thing that everyone kind of makes kind of clear. You don't understand unless you saw them live, which is kind of crazy to think about. But, you know, then you have John Cale saying, oh yeah, we tuned everything to the hum of our refrigerator. And it's just like, just this weird stuff. It's like all this, like all this tonal, like experimental stuff. Like, we're talking about, like, they're pulling influences from like John Cage and like all these crazy disparate influences coming together to make a rock band, and just, beautifully made, Haynes really captures the sort of the vibe of it all while also doing a really good job of sort of relating the story. And again, you're not going to get like a ABC kind of like story of the Velvet Underground out of this, but I think I think it comes as close as you're going to sort of capturing like what that band sort of meant to people, both the people who were in it, the people who were near it, and the people who have just experienced it. And to be able to sort of put that on screen, that feeling, is a really impressive accomplishment. And I have to say, if you're a fan of the band, obviously, if you're a fan of music docs in general, or just, God, just good movie making, like, you should really check this one out. It's currently streaming on Apple TV Plus. And I think it is at a limited theatrical engagement, although I don't know that it's playing anywhere in our vicinity. But yeah, The Velvet Underground, man, I was not fully prepared for what I was getting, but I sure am glad I got it.
All right. And finally, Alan Adams from The Main Edge talking movies with us. I'm sure if somebody told you 25 years ago, the next time these Goodwill Hunting guys get together to write a movie script, it's going to be for a Ridley Scott medieval knights doing battle film.
Yeah, you know, oh, yeah, sure. They're going to adapt a nonfiction book about, you know, dudes fighting in the Crusades. That makes sense. That tracks. Yeah, so The Last Duel. I was unsure of all of this, just because, like, I was very much looking forward to it. I think there are... The reality is, like, it's stacked in front of and behind the camera. Like, Ridley Scott, for a guy who's in his mid-80s, is still dealing. Like, yeah. he could still get it done, which is great. But again, the big story, as you mentioned, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck working on a screenplay together, first time since they won the Oscar for Good Will Hunting. Remarkable to think that they haven't written anything together since then.
Yeah.
But they wrote it along with a woman named Nicole Holofcener, who also contributed to the screenplay. And it's as you said, it's a story of two men and the woman between them in 14th century France.
But it sounds like an interesting way that they present the different perspectives.
Yep, it's I mean, the shorthand is it's got a Rashomon vibe, because we open in the sort of somber preparation for a duel. We have two men, Matt Damon and Adam Driver, getting strapped into their armor, getting their swords, their lances, getting on their horses, going, addressing the king, and preparing to duel. The duel starts, and just as impact is about to ensue, cut, title card, chapter one, and that's when we get the chapter devoted to Jean de Carrouge, and that is Matt Damon's character, who is a warrior. He's a scarred, kind of sullen. He's a guy who's been fighting for the King of France for a number of years, doing battle. One of his good friends, Jacques Legris, played by Adam Driver, beside him, and they're basically going all over Europe, fighting on behalf of the king, and more directly, fighting on behalf of their patron, their lord, who has recently been replaced by a gentleman by the name of Pierre. Played by Ben Affleck, who, might I add, is spectacular in this movie. He is so, like, they're all good, but Affleck really crushes it. So De Grouge is, he's down on his luck a little bit. His finances are in a bit of disarray. He's holding out hope to assume the captaincy held by his father, but he's also looking for other ways to supplement his estate, which leads to him agreeing to wed the daughter of a person who has been deemed a traitor to the crown, since pardoned, but sided, took the wrong side in an earlier conflict. And so he marries this man's daughter, a woman named Marguerite, played by the excellent Jodie Comer. Like I said, stacked cast. Mm. He takes her dowry, goes back to his estates, and they start their lives together. As often happens in these situations, Carouge is called back into battle. He also develops a bit of an issue with Pierre, who has taken a real shine to Legree and has sort of put him in a position of favor. That leads to even more conflict. He goes away to war, comes back, has to go to Paris to get paid. And when he returns to a shaken Marguerite, who tells him, while you were gone, I was raped. And the rapist is Jacques Legree. We go to court, etc. Cut. Chapter 2. Jacques Legree. And what happens is the story plays out again, only from Legree's perspective. Mm. And so we see some of the same scenes, but we also get to see the sort of origins of Pierre's patronage to Jacques Legree. And we get a sense of, you know, how he considers himself and and what actually did. We get to see him make his way to de Carouge's castle and encounter Marguerite, and we see that situation play out in an unsettling manner, let's say. And bear in mind, this is through his eyes, and it still plays as pretty upsetting. He denies the charges. We were in the court. He's dealing with the clergy, etc., etc. Cut to chapter 3. Marguerite's the truth according to Marguerite, and then there's a fade, leaving just the truth on screen.
Mm.
And this is where we see how these people really are, not how they perceive themselves, not how they believe themselves to operate in the world, but how they truly are. And it's bleak, de Carouge is an oaf, an insensitive egomaniac. Legree is slimy and entitled. Frankly, the only one who never really changes is Pierre, who's just a high camp mincing jerk the entire time. Again, Affleck's clearly having a blast. But then we go through the court situation again, and the whole deal is de Carouge demands satisfaction. Jacques denies the charges, and so the only way for there to be any sort of justice is for de Carouge to challenge Jacques to a duel because, and this is pointed out very specifically, this is not a crime against a person. This is a crime against a man's property.
Oh, boy.
You know, like that's the world as it was.
Right.
And to see that sort of rendered so nakedly, it's tough. Like, and you know, we do revisit the scene where Legree takes advantage in the bedroom, and from Marguerite's perspective, it's awful. Like, it is awful. And if you are someone who struggles with those sorts of portrayals on screen, I would advise you to strongly consider whether you're prepared to see this, because it is brutal, and it feels very real. In a way that we don't often see on screen, that's in the way it's presented. And then at the end, we do get the titular last duel, and that is how the storylines come back together, because we're all in the same place, operating under the same auspices. Look, Ridley Scott can do epic. Like, we've seen it on a number of occasions, and this sort of, like, soldiers doing what soldiers do in this particular time period is something that Ridley Scott is very good at representing. The sort of technique, I guess, I'm not entirely sure, the stylistic choices with regards to how this story is told are fascinating, because we do get to see, like, they are three separate stories, but the moments of overlap, we get to see the same scene play out in different ways, and they are slightly different in a way that is really, I think my favorite part is there's one particular scene wherein you know, when it's de Gerouge, he believes he says this moving sort of speech. When it's Legree, Legree believes he says the same moving sort of speech. And then when Marguerite, it's someone completely different who makes the speech. Wow. You know, it just like things like that. Mm. And it's just like it's so intricately constructed. There's a lot, and it's a long movie. There's a lot of moving parts. It gets a little messy in places. But again, like I said, Ridley Scott, hell of a filmmaker, and can't be stressed enough. The incredible, incredible talent in this cast. Damon is great. You know, he's got this like mullet, like chin beard combo that make like you see him and it's just like, oh, this guy, what is this guy about? You know, he's scarred himself up, and just really, this sort of ponderousness to him, this almost sort of slowness that he's imposed on his, on himself that really is very, very impactful. Set opposite Driver, who is just, and we've talked about Adam Driver a number of times, like he's incredibly talented, and he has a particular gift for subverting his generous natural charisma in service of villainy. He's done that on a number of occasions. He does it here in a way that is both reminiscent of and different from the ways he's done it in the past, which is really fascinating to watch. Jodie Comer is quietly the absolute foundation of this film. Like I'm sure there are other actresses who could have handled the demands of this role. I can't name them right now. Like I certainly can't imagine anyone doing it better than her. Remarkable work from her. And again, I know I've mentioned it a couple of times, but Affleck just prancing around, like just the ultimate like libertine jerk. And it's so fun to watch him clearly embrace this sort of mincing heel turn that he's doing. He's just tremendous fun to watch whenever he's on screen. And it's just, and the supporting cast is packed with people who are notable in their own right, whether it's stage, screen, or television. Just a tremendous cast of actors, performers. Ridley Scott is great. The script, Affleck and Damon did the male chapters, and Nicole Holofcener did the female chapter, which is inspired. It was an inspired choice. I think it was absolutely the 100% right way to handle it. Because it gave a real depth to all three chapters that I don't know would have been there had it been just a singular screenwriter, male or female. And so to be able to bring those perspectives together in such a way that, you know, the connective tissue is there, but they're still very distinct and all that. Just, and then, you know, the duel itself is brutal. In a very medieval kind of way. That was, again, a real trip to watch. Like I said, it's long, it's a lot, might not be for everyone, but I got to tell you, Rich, I think there's a very real chance that, you know, we're going to be having a conversation about this movie down the road.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
Alan Adams talking movies past the popcorn.